This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 120, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Steve Findlay to discuss the super important topic of two tribes: what VCs don't know about entrepreneurs and what entrepreneurs don't know about VCs. Stephen is a great person to start the new year off with, as he has a varied background. He spent 12 years investing and advising in technology venture capital and mid-market private equity, including co-founding Fidelity's $500 million technology buyout fund. He had a coding sabbatical in 2012-13, is an angel investor, and along with Bond Mason, who we'll talk about later in the show, who enabled clients to invest in loans secured against UK property, he's co-founded a stablecoin startup last year. Last, and no doubt least, he's a chartered accountant. We'll touch on some of these topics in the show. However, his background is clearly ideal to discuss the challenges that exist in almost all fintech firms, and indeed, for that matter, in all listed firms, between two tribes: investors, or capital providers, and founders/management. This challenge of two tribes is centuries old. In my interviews now with some over 60 folk on the management of unlisted boards, the most vitriol by far has come from founders/CEOs about VCs. Equally, as you might imagine, VC's biggest pain in the derriere can be the management of a firm. So how can this culture divide, this divide of objectives and perspectives, be best managed? It's an excellent and super important question. Let's ask a man who is, as it were, bilingual and who has lived in both countries. First, what each country and language are like and what the people are trying to achieve there. And secondly, how the two can get along better. And this getting along better, having a smooth board, is definitely a win-win proposition for fintech and pretty essential in the long term. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Steve. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for having me on the London FinTech Podcast. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. So you were saying on the lift coming up that you just listened to the previous episode, which was the New Year special, which is very atypical, as it's me sort of zooming up to the super big picture of tech as a whole, and in particular tech FS tyranny, which of course continues to get worse. I see that in passing since I did that episode that the new global censor, MasterCard, has blocked various death metal bands, the wrong kind of music. I guess, financial deplatforming. There's an article about that in this week's Spectator. And interestingly, actually, and this leads into one of your interests and one of your activities. One of my loyal South African listeners emailed me to say he was very interested in the show. And in terms of can tech actually change itself to help move away from this concentration of power, which is actually causing the difficulty, this chap emailed me about I2P, which I certainly hadn't heard of I2P. And I should quote Wikipedia in passing. I2P, the Invisible Internet Project, is an anonymous network layer that allows for censorship-resistant peer-to-peer communication. Anonymous connections are achieved by encrypting the user's traffic and sending it through a volunteer-run network of roughly 55,000 computers distributed around the world, which sounds like the kind of old-fashioned peer-to-peer before peer-to-peer was used in fintech. Anyway, it's a very sort of serious way of diving in, but one of the things, as you will have heard me say, was that Bitcoin seems a little bit of a parable for our times, really, in that something that was, quotes, designed to be decentralized, unquotes, ends up getting incredibly centralized, and apart from minor matters like killing polar bears, the price goes up and down like a complete yo-yo. And it would be really nice to have some tech protocols which, shall we say, made massive over-concentration of power in one place less likely rather than more likely. So the show isn't about stablecoins or anything like that, but maybe wearing your sort of tech hat, as you say, you're coding and to do stablecoin stuff, you know, you're going along those kind of directions. Maybe just tell us a little bit about that. We can talk about some non-tech, non-FSE stuff in a second, do it the wrong way around for a change.
Sure, very happy to, Mike. I think it's really interesting. I think you can look at Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, blockchain technology. It's still very new. I know it's only sort of 10 years old, and people talk about every time there is some sort of step change of innovation, things accelerate and happen faster, but it's still a new technology fundamentally. And there are issues with a lot of cryptocurrencies around them being centralized, despite, as you note, the entire purpose of the underlying technology, it being decentralized. And only this week, I think there's a 51% attack, as it's called, on one of the cryptocurrencies where thieves sort of stole off with $1 million. Just shows that because it's not yet well adopted and widely adopted, actually there are a few small participants, whether they be good or bad, depending on how you look at them, in each case, who still control the journey and the destiny of these various blockchain technologies. So I think the underlying premise can be sound. It just needs to be a lot more mature and a lot more widely adopted before we can start to consider relying upon it in our day-to-day world.
Indeed, and Bitcoin is, whatever it is, version 2.0 of some sort of non-governmental currency type of things, because, I don't know, we had sort of kind of gold coin or whatever it was back in the day. And again, without going to Bitcoin, there are dimensions of challenge and issue that version 2.0 has thrown up that future computer scientists are going to have to solve if we get to the stage where Bitcoin 10.0 is the global currency. And if you're in Venezuela or something, or even here or wherever, that actually it's then got a good use case. And so one of them is, how can you do this without killing polar bears? That's one dimension. Another is, how can you do it without the value going up and down tenfold every other 15 minutes?
Sure.
And the sort of not going up and down tenfold in every 15 minutes is the issue that the stable coins are trying to solve. So do you want to just give us a little taste of that? Maybe at some stage in the future I'll do something on stable coins if it actually catches on.
For sure. I think, well, there's two ideas which are often conflated. One is, what is a cryptocurrency, and what is blockchain technology? Those are the two key distinctions we're all trying to make here. And I think the challenge is the two are kind of joined at the hip, and Bitcoin is the poster child for blockchain technology. And because you can buy a Bitcoin, and because people can speculate, therefore, on the price of a Bitcoin, that is used to speculate on the success or otherwise potentially of blockchain technology. Yet in the meantime, it's meant to serve as a currency, albeit a cryptocurrency, but a currency. And if you delve into what a currency should do for you, for its holders and its users and adopters, it's really meant to be doing sort of three things. So one is being a medium of exchange, which means you can transfer it from A to B. The other is being some sort of measure of value, so you know how much your pint of Guinness or your phone subscription is going to cost. And the third element is the fact that it's kind of homogenous, so people can trade it quite easily. Those things don't really work in the Bitcoin world because of its volatility, as you've noted. So actually, its behavior as a currency is very poor. From my own perspective personally, as we'll come on and talk about, I've always been keenly interested in innovation and technology, whether it's in my professional guise as an investor or whether it's in a personal capacity. And I think blockchain technology has the capacity and will ultimately impact the way that lots of industries operate, in particular financial services, which is where my experience lies. So we in 2017 spent some time looking at that technology. We built what was the first regulated cryptocurrency, certainly in Europe, potentially in the world.
What's it called?
It's called the ARC Reserve Currency, or the AAA Reserve Currency, and it's regulated out of Jersey. So we worked very closely with the Jersey regulator on that. For us, the interest lay really in the implementation of the technology. And what I specifically mean is how you can create a fund management wrapper using blockchain technology and existing regulations hand in hand.
And just on the stable dimension, how do you make your AAA coin more stable than Bitcoin?
Sure. So the reason it's stable is because it's backed by an asset.
So it's a bit like version 1.0, which was gold coin in the past, was it?
Well, even simpler, it's backed by currency as the asset. So cash is the asset.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it's backed by a portfolio of global currencies. So we started off with SDR, so the standard drawing reserve currency, which is, however, managed by a committee. So that clearly has a centralization issue. So instead, we used the trade weighting currency of the Bank of International Settlements to say, right, we'll hold this much dollars, this much sterling, this much Canadian dollars, so on and so forth. So that gives us its first dimension. A basket of currencies is fundamentally less volatile than a single currency.
So basically, and I don't want to dive into this because it's a very big topic on the VCs, we did do something with positive money, I think, last year or the year before on positive money, i.e. money that means real stuff, i.e. in the past you could go to the Bank of England with your £5 note and say, can you give me £5, please, i.e. of value. Simplifying it massively, you may or may not be able to do this with yours, but in essence, you are at the stage that the Bank of England was when money was backed by something, and you could go there and I could say, oh, I don't want my AAA coins anymore, please, can I have some DOSH? And you'll actually, in principle, be able to give me the DOSH because it's there.
Yeah.
It's not kind of something which is based on nothing, as it were.
Correct, and not just in principle, in practice, that's exactly what we've been doing for the last year and a half with it. So people can buy in dollars and sterling and euros, whatever it might be. Subject, I want to quickly add, to AML KYC checks, because it's a regulated thing. And then they can choose to sell that coin back for dollars or sterling or whatever currency they may want to receive. The second element to it, so that diversification brings with it less volatility. It actually has been three times less volatile than US dollar over the comparative period. So it's not just stable relative to cryptocurrencies, it's actually stable relative to national currencies too. The second element is because you're holding these cash balances in bank accounts, as we all know, if you have more than £85,000 or euros in a bank account, it's not protected by FSCS, so actually you're taking credit risk on that bank. So we took that and thought, well, given we've got a lot of fixed income expertise, let's use that, swap that credit risk and get paid for it. So rather than putting cash in a bank, sacrifice some liquidity, buy the debt of that bank, so you actually get credit returns. However, if you're going to buy and invest in the credit world, you're probably not going to buy the debt of banks, given what happened in the last 10 years. So actually you end up buying gilts and bonds to deliver you a bit of a credit return for the risk you're taking. Net, net, the benefit of that is you can track inflation. And that's a really powerful thing because our currency, in theory, can track inflation over time.
Right. OK, well, so that's interesting. And when we spoke on the phone, I was running out of enthusiasm for 2018. Unfortunately, it's 2019, so my enthusiasm's come back again. And I did say something along the lines, well, stable coins sound potentially interesting, but aren't they rubbish? which is clear they're not completely rubbish because actually people have thought about some of this stuff. And when you've overtaken Bitcoin and you're managing the world, then do come back and let's dive into that a little bit more. But today's topic is very big. We've glossed over what I normally start with the show with, which is trying to demonstrate to the audience that the guest is a human being. We haven't actually demonstrated you're a human being. We've demonstrated that you do lots of homework on lots of subjects simultaneously, but maybe that's part of the VC. So very briefly, what was your sort of human being journey from the egg to today? Fast forwarding about a millionfold.
No, absolutely. My voice doesn't give it away. I was actually born in Canada, moved to New Zealand, grew up in England, now married to a Scottish wife, so have a sort of a global worldview. I have three young children, which I'm delighted to say, 6, 5, and 1. But the personal journey is, and it will come out in the conversation, so I won't dwell on it here too much, but there's been moments in my career where I've taken a conscious decision to balance work and life. And one of my former bosses, who is actually now our chairman of Bond Mason, always used to advocate getting that balance of working to live versus living to work and getting that the right way around. And that was in a time in my career where I was doing 14 to 16 hours a day, 5, 6 days a week, and did that for about 10 years.
This is why you turned grey, somewhat.
Which is why I'm probably grey before my years and had a midlife crisis before my years, probably.
But you're clearly still a masochist, and this may come from being a VC and that kind of world, as you are doing all these different things. I mean, Bond Mason will come on to, but that is a proper business that I'm sure takes up lots of time and lots of thinking, and equally creating stable coins, apart from all your other activities. So from my perspective, you're perhaps less of a masochist than you were, but you're still a sort of a small M masochist, aren't you, trying to do lots of things?
Yeah, I think I try and balance doing lots of different things.
Or maybe just don't waste all your time on Twitter, unlike me.
Well, I don't. Do you know, I've tried to get off of social media as much as I can.
I've done the same thing. People who listen to the newer special, as you do, will clearly understand that actually, you know, I get sucked into this every now and then I just have to try and give it up. Because otherwise, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, my God, not only is Theresa May a complete dictator, the speaker's a dictator. And, you know, one of the mottos that I saw, which is a really good one for me this year, and I recommend for listeners who have the same sort of issues, is spend more time creating rather than reacting.
I've not heard that before, but I think it's a really good adage. And there's so many different echo chambers. You know, in the blockchain Bitcoin world, if you join all these Telegram groups, the noise that you get out of that is incredible, and there's very little substance to much of it.
Full of sound and fury signifying nothing.
Exactly. And I just try and focus on things that are interesting to me, quite selfishly. And whether that's my family, which I would, commit a significant chunk of my time to, and very, very happily so, or things in quote-unquote work, which I don't actually see as work, I just find it fascinating, then very happy to look at these different things. I think it probably does stem from the venture capital private equity world and that sort of career whereby actually you are multitasking, even though it is a single job that you have, whether it's looking after the portfolio and a number of portfolio companies, which we'll talk about the boards in a moment, and governance, or looking for the next investment opportunity, or indeed looking to divest your current portfolio and everything in between. So you have to spin a few plates in that industry, which is perhaps why I enjoyed it and liked it so much. But I've kind of continued that mindset, having jumped across the table.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a bit like, I suspect, being a triathlete and doing Ironmans and that kind of stuff. If you've got used to actually fitting that into your life and doing it, and then you back off to just running marathons. You think, oh, I'm taking it easy. Whereas compared to a sort of lazy sod who's quite useless like me, you're working quite hard. And the other thing, of course, that you say, which is a secret, and then we must move on to the main course topic, is actually to enjoy what you're doing. So, you know, in terms of my sort of wind-down protocol, I went to see a buddy of mine who's far older and wiser than I for sort of a shamanic journeying and a nice lunch in a country pub, which is a good sort of combo, just before Christmas. Actually, anybody who wants to do shamanic stuff in the UK, check out Leo Rutherford. He's been at it for 30 years. Very interesting background himself. Anyway, he's about 84, and he looks so young and radiant because he enjoys what he's doing. It's not work. He does it, you know, he doesn't do that much because he doesn't need to, but it's really enjoyable. And from enjoyment comes enthusiasm, and enthusiasm will take you quite a long way. Now, talking then about enthusiasm and doing triathlons and all that kind of stuff, as I said in the intro, there are these two tribes, and having spent a lot of time in the last 18 months, getting on for 2 years now, talking to people about, as it were, living in France and being French and living in Germany and being German, there are not that many. Nigel Verdon was on the show. He's another, he's kind of done both sides, but he didn't do so much VCing in the end. He's much more of a founder entrepreneur. It's really very good just to start off understanding what VCs are like, what it's like being a VC, what they're trying to do, and then the same with entrepreneurs. Now, everybody kind of thinks they know that, and everybody does to an extent, but my feeling, having spoken to lots of people, and say there are some serious moans, and people are seriously unhappy on both sides, sometimes with the other partner. It's like any relationship in life. If you don't get the right relationship, it's going to be a difficulty for both. Which is that people can kind of intellectually know that, oh yes, VCs are there, they're managing a fund, they need to do returns, they need liquidity, yada, 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 yada. But somehow they don't get it in their bones. They've lost the feel for it, you know, the sort of tangibility, and vice versa. There are plenty of not that good VCs that kind of are busy being VCs, and they don't really get what it feels to be like the founder. So, to start with the VCs then, you did 12 years as a VC, so you know what that's like.
So I think, and there is a really subtle but very important distinction here. So I worked in private equity as distinct from venture capital, and the two are quite often traded quite quickly. And I was at the lower mid-market private equity, so we're looking for growth firms.
Okay, so let's start with definitions then. So under no definition, a VC, a low market PE, a big market PE, because certainly over my experience in the last N decades, the word big in terms of money has changed quite a lot over 30 years.
Absolutely. So there's two key distinctions. Venture capital is a minority investor. So you're investing your money for less than 50%, so typically not control, despite what the documents might look like, despite how you might operate, conduct yourself. And you do that quite often alongside other VCs at the same time. So you're investing cash into a business to make it grow. Private equity is typically, buyout investing, you are purchasing shares. You're not investing into a company, you're buying the shares off of another shareholder for a variety of different reasons. And you're typically doing that in a control way, so you're owning more than 51% of the equity of the company. And you're typically, therefore, doing that on your own as a fund. You don't do that alongside other venture capital, you know, other private equity investors. You're doing that on your own. You may use bank debt to support it, but it's very much you and your fund that controls and runs that business. So that's a really key distinction, because the mindset around private equity is very much, we own this business, we say how it goes, we are potentially more on the hook for whether or not it's going to be a success or not, certainly in the eyes of our own funds investors, and therefore we will do everything that we need to do within our powers to make this a success. Whereas a VC, typically you have less strings you can pull, and therefore you should be really backing the team as much as you are backing, you know, the market or the product. So it's really about who are the founders, who are the team. You need to get that decision right out of all the decisions at the time you invest. Whereas with private equity, as we did across the sort of 10 years or so, a couple of funds I worked at, we changed about 70% of the C-level executives across all the firms.
Over what time scale of investment are you changing them?
The standard horizon sort of 3 years. So, you know, significant senior management change. Now, the hardest one to change, obviously, is chief executive, but we'd probably change a chief executive in one out of three businesses, maybe one out of two.
And this is probably an unfair question, but if you had to guess what a similar stat would be for VC-backed companies?
Well, I think VC is really changing the CEO as your nuclear button.
It's happened once or twice in fintech, Nutmeg being a prime example that everyone will have heard of.
It has, but you know, Nick, I think, was kind of managed into a non-executive director role. You know, he's still involved in the business. He's still kind of aligned with it as a success. And you know, I'm sure they're still talking to each other quite regularly. With private equity, it's binary. You're in or you're out. And if you're out, you're out. But then that doesn't mean it's the end of the investment. Whereas venture capital, more often than not, there isn't a CEO succession which leads to a successful exit.
So an important distinction here is that private equity act like owners and control. It's their business. It's your business. It's like you've got, for the sake of argument, you've got a gardener and he's digging up your roses. Sorry, mate, you can't dig the roses. You're fired. See you later. Right, you know.
Correct.
New gardener. Whereas the VCs, are not, and of course often people have several VCs, don't have that direct control. However, if you draw a spectrum, shall we say, of 0.49% or 49% of the equity, VCs will act rather differently along that spectrum. And you did say something in passing, which is quite important, which is that although they don't have control, they may kind of act like that.
Well, I think that's right. It's difficult to generalise, but you know, let's do that. And also, let's try and get the colourful anecdotal stuff out on the table, because you know, if I talk in banal generalities, that's, you know, you probably switch your listeners will switch off for the
hell of it. No, that's my job. I talk in banal generalities.
But I think, you know, VCs' mindset, you have lots of different VCs, clearly, and I think their style is probably directly correlated, more often than not, to their level of success. And I think the issue in both VC and PE is you get the survivorship bias. So the people that have been successful in their investments are the ones that you continue to see over time. And sadly, I don't think there's as much humility as you might want to see in the PE VC industry. So you speak to a successful VC or PE and they'll tell you how they've been successful. They'll tell you how their decisions made them very wealthy. Sadly, quite forgetting that there's lowly management teams working their backsides off to deliver these great
companies. And also, it's better to be lucky than good. If I buy 25 shares at the FTSE 100, in 10 years' time, I'll be able to tell you about the dozen that did bloody great.
No, exactly. So I think that's always a bit of a challenge. I think, therefore, it's probably difficult to find a successful VC who's gone through three or four funds who isn't willing isn't guarded about sharing their opinion, i.e. they will come in and make it very clear how they want things to be. Which in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Well, at least you know where they're coming from.
As long as they're consistent, I think that's quite important, and willing, like the team should be, to recognise quickly when they get decisions wrong. So it's better to take a whole load of decisions and then realise quickly which ones you've got wrong and focus on the ones you've got well and do that consistently as a group. The style point, I'm less fussed about. You know, if someone wants to come in and bang a table, or if someone wants to come in and be passive aggressive, I couldn't care a jot either way, quite frankly. If they've got the capability and skill to help build a better business, that's kind of what it's all about, really.
Right, OK, well, we'll come on in a minute in terms of the relationship between the two into the stylistic point, into is a good board member somebody who comes and gives you a kicking every time, just to stop you getting complacent? Is he someone who comes and loves you all the time, or does he sort of randomly vary, or does he systematically vary? You know, the sort of the usual cliche, which is that you want somebody who actually supports you when you're down on your luck and life's going against you, and actually challenges you when you think everything's going wonderful and you know, you can walk on water. But actually, there's the other way around process as well. So, okay, so that's a bit of a feel for where they're coming from those sides. And I think the obvious thing, which everybody will know, which we haven't touched on, which is that actually capital providers are putting their capital into something to make money.
Correct.
And not only that, generally, I mean, certainly in the VC's case, I'm not so familiar with the PE stuff, but they are doing that in a fund structure, and the people what put their money, like pension funds, into that fund want their money back at some point. And therefore, this in itself gives constraints that a founder might not have. I found the London FinTech podcast. It grows into an enormous success and takes over MasterCard, and I stop MasterCard being a global sensor in 10 years or 20 years. It doesn't really matter to me. I mean, I work a bit more. But whereas if you're a VC funding that, and you'll say, actually, the real reason of the London FinTech podcast is to take over MasterCard one day and stop them centering stuff, but our fund only lasts 7 years, so you can't have 15 years, Mike. You're out, kind of stuff. You know. So there's a time-scaly thing here. So just moving on from that, hearing what you say about VCs, I absolutely recognise that sort of archetype, shall we say, and in my fantasies of infinite power, then what I would like to do with some of those people, just for the pure development of their own soul, is to take to them and say, okay, clever clogs, right, go and found your own business. See you later, let me know how you get on. What is it like, then, being an entrepreneur, founder, CEO? Felt sense, because again, everybody's heard hundreds of people on the show like that, but what's kind of the felt sense about that? You haven't done it a couple of times around.
I feel very pleased and happy that I took that decision to jump the table. The driver for that was not so much a career-driven thing, actually more of a lifestyle-driven thing. You know, I want to make sure that family, you know, came first. I was, you know, just got married, wanted to have kids, wanted to be able to see them, and you know, private equity career that I was doing wouldn't facilitate that, wouldn't be conducive with that. So that was really the catalyst, as well as trying to scratch the itch of having this interest, this level of interest that I couldn't satisfy through my private equity degree around innovation, technology, and all those sorts of good things. So those are really the drivers. But having jumped the fence, you know, they are very, very different spaces to be in. You know, in private equity, venture capital, you're part of a team, you're working as a committee, you're working with all these portfolio companies, there's lots and lots of people around. As a startup founder, day one, it's just you. And it's you in your bedroom or your garden shed or wherever you may be sat. And it's a very lonely place, quite frankly. And I don't, you know, not looking for violins at that point in time, but it is a lonely place. So what you immediately gain in terms of being master of your own destiny and being able to control what you do every day and control where things go, you know, the flip side of that is you're 100% responsible for all of the above. And that, bizarrely, doesn't really change. So, you know, I've been kind of on the other side of the table now for 5 or 6 years. Bond Mason, we founded 5 years ago. We've had a couple of EIS rounds. We've got a team of 18 of us. In some ways, you know, I feel very fortunate because the team is fantastic. But equally, in some ways, you still are quite isolated and lonely as being a sort of a chief executive, actually. That's more of a, you know, probably a discussion for another day. But it's certainly the case. And I think for any other founder that's out there, they'll probably be able to, you know, it's a point that will resonate on them, is the fact that they will live and breathe their business clearly more than anyone else, and quite rightly. And that is a stressful thing. You know, emotionally, physically, all those sorts of challenges come through. But that's probably why we do it. We're probably, you know, slightly used the M word before about being masochistic. That's probably why we do it, because we enjoy that challenge. We enjoy the thrill, and that what makes us tick and probably makes us live a bit.
Yes, I think that's probably the heart of it, really, this loneliness aspect. And certainly having spoken to dozens of CEOs about the board and all that kind of thing, then the archetypal picture or the cartoon picture, which sums up a lot of the conversations, is along the lines that if you're a founder and you're doing the annual fundraising over 15 months or whatever it is, which is hellishly time-consuming and very emotionally draining, you know, it's going badly. You wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock, you can't bloody sleep for hours, and you're going, oh shit, it's a disaster. You know, at 4 o'clock in the morning is the time when most people die, and that, you know, your life force is literally low, and you think, oh god, you know, everyone's had, oh, this disaster, and how am I going to do this, and yada yada yada. And then you've got to turn up in the morning, have a strong coffee, walking with a big smile on your face, saying, hey, it's all going great, guys. You know, and it's almost like you're forced to sort of to lie to yourself and this kind of thing. And it's that kind of thing that I've appreciated from speaking to lots of people, which doesn't come through in any literature or anything like that, really, which is that, although the following has come through, which is that if you are a founder and you are putting together a board, we'll put the VC stuff to one side and all that, then somewhere, maybe from the VCs or maybe not from the VC, maybe just from somebody with grey hair and no hair as a non-executive director, one of the things that is immensely helpful from the CEOs and founders I've spoken to about this is to have somebody on the board who you can be completely honest with and who will give you avuncular support. You will have a coffee with, have a beer, and he'll say, yeah, I've been there myself. It's shit, isn't it? It's an absolute bloody nightmare. Sorry that, Steve. Yeah, look, have a cup of coffee. Let's chat about it. How do you feel when you wake up? Like, yada, yada, yada. Just actually that emotional support. Now, especially in our culture, there is a thing that sort of, especially men, tend to be grown up along the lines that you should be able to do everything yourself. And if you're a founder, you should have been doing it yourself and stand on your own 2 feet and yada, yada, yada. Yeah, sure. And actually, the people who succeed do that. But everybody could do with an arm around the shoulder now and then.
They could. I would argue I'd see that as a role for a mentor, actually not being necessarily on the board. I'd also add, and I can be contrarian and happy to conflict with views, I think you should be honest with your board, actually, at all times. And I don't think you should be overly reserved with your board, particularly if you're at the VC stage. You know, private equity is slightly harder because they want to see grown-ups and you shouldn't be washing all your laundry in public. So, you know, as a CEO of a
go
private equity
go tell your
firm,
wife, go and tell your analyst kind
yeah,
of thing.
As a CEO of a private equity board, you know, good luck. You've just got to make the business work, and that is what it is. Whereas with a VC board, you've got to share your problems. And if the VC can't handle that, then that's more of a problem for them than it is for you. They don't want to be changing the chief executive. They want the business to be a success. And I think the challenge with keeping that relationship working well is making sure the VC is engaged. I'd far rather a VC came into an office or a board meeting, banged the table, shouted, then came in and sat down and didn't say anything, because I want them to care. I want them to be passionate about our business. And a VC fund that backs 15 businesses, they need 2 to be successful, 2 to return the money, and they don't care if the other 10 at that point are write-offs. You don't want to be one of those other 10. You want to be one of the 2 or 4 that they care about. So being engaged, being truthful, being open, being honest, getting those problems out early should hopefully get to a better outcome, because you can address them faster.
Yes, I don't think that's contrary slightly, because actually I quite like sort of somebody ping-ponging the ball back. It makes it a bit more challenging to ping-pong it back again. But I don't think that's contrarian. I think that actually that just my research experience of speaking to people is a superset of that. So clearly there are a large number of CEOs, especially if they've got, quotes, good VCs, we'll come on to good and bad VCs and good and bad CEOs, who especially after a period of time when everybody knows each other, are very open. You know, look, the fundraising is going shit. It's a bloody disaster. You know, I'm waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and the VCs don't give them a good kicking and say, oh, you're obviously the wrong person if you wake up at 2 o'clock, da-da-da-da-da-da. They're experienced people who've been around the block and know that that's the way it is. And the fact the CEO is saying that is good because they know he's being honest rather than he's some wimp. You know, we need to get someone who's not a wimp. And one of the comments I've heard is that it's not just quote good and bad VCs, it's the stage. You get some 26-year-old VC who's trying to make a name for himself. He'll try and sort of kick you even if you're 39 and you're saying you wake up in the morning because he thinks he's being sort of tough macho man and all that kind of stuff. So your VC mileage may vary. And in terms of the mentorship, absolutely, there are some people who have mentors outside, but there are also a number of CEOs, especially in the younger growing firms, who find they get mentored from within the board, as well as have somebody who is there in his own rights. It is really the somebody that's sort of older and wiser. And yeah, for people who are less experienced in the boardroom than you, and you're hyper-experienced in the boardroom, and let's not forget, most CEOs you can think of in fintech, most fintechs we could name off the top of our head, they're the first time around. Mm-hmm. They've never actually sat in a small room like this with a small number of people, so they don't know what they're doing. Often they get that, ideally, perhaps, from an experienced chairman who might be 10, 15, 20 years older,
yep,
who has been through the same things himself, and he does take you for a coffee, and he, yep, says so-and-so. And if you're in that situation, you're not going to complain, Steve, if the chairman takes you for a coffee outside the meeting, having perhaps given you a kicking and a hard time in the meeting or defended you from nasty VCs or whatever, and says, OK, look, tell me about it then, Sonny.
One of the things we used to do in our private equity boards, in every case, was try and recruit a non-executive chairman who had that PE-backed managerial experience, so they could actually work as translator between us as PE fund and the chief executive, and that was incredibly important and worked very, very well. Private equity puts you in a slightly weird position. I moved into it when I was 24 years old, into an established fund. So what that meant is on the first day I became...
I thought you winced when I was talking about young 20-somethings who give companies a good kicking.
No, this is the thing. And it's, you know, if I could talk to my 24-year-old self, I'd have a few choice words to say. But
wouldn't we all, actually?
On day one, I got assigned, you know, as board observer, not officially as a director, board observer of three portfolio companies. It's you and one of the other persons from the private equity fund. If they can't attend, in that month's meeting, you are the sole person who sort of determines what gets done and said going forward. So, and then you're doing three board meetings a month thereafter, at least. So you do get quite a lot of board experience very, very quickly at a very, very young age. And whilst when you're 24 and you're first doing it, you should always be humble and what have you, but you certainly don't know what's going on. By the time you're 27, 28, bizarrely, you've actually had 12 years at least of board experience. And you are actually quite experienced, bizarrely, at that very early age. And again, I don't say this but for any other reason than context, but the first 10 years of my career went very, very quickly. I was a partner of a private equity fund when I was 28. So you do get into these weird positions very, very quickly. And actually, chief executives, if you deliver that correctly, appreciate that. They appreciate the insights as long as you are good. And I'm not saying that I was the best private equity person by any means, certainly wasn't that. I just tried to be good. I just tried to be consistent, fair, firm, but, you know, provide insight where I could. But importantly, defer to their insight because, you know, they're the ones living and breathing it. And it's a challenge. It's not, you know, you're spinning plates and it's difficult to keep them all going round and round.
Yes, and one of the secrets, I was told this 30 years ago, actually, I remember asking, it was a JP Morgan broker when I was running the bond management stuff, about being a broker. I said, how do you know all this stuff? And they said, well, we have to get in early, we can read the newspaper. He said, but actually, I've known him for a while, he's one of my main brokers. He said, what I just do is tell the next phone call whatever the last bloke told me, which was sort of interesting, you know. And so I'm always recycling interesting stuff. I'm always picking up interesting stuff. And, you know, after a while, with that algorithm, you end up knowing all sorts of interesting, amazing facts to amuse your friends at sherry parties.
And that's exactly true in private equity. And, you know, it was kind of one of the reasons when I stepped out of private equity, after I'd been doing sort of 10 years of tech investing, but was an accountant by training. And I was kind of just duplicating, repeating these tech insights from one board meeting to the next. So I then spent a year and a half learning to code and program to actually get into the detail of these sorts of things. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not to say that the observations making those previous board meetings weren't worthwhile. Hopefully they were and were meaningful and we had, you know, some successful exits. So, you know, hopefully I helped contribute to some of that sort of stuff. But it is a weird situation where you get 20-somethings telling 40-somethings what they should be doing.
Yes, it must remind me not to get aboard on the London FinTech podcast. The one thing actually listening to you that just occurs to me, again, I'm just trying to give a feel of this because actually almost all listeners will know about all this kind of stuff. So I think the feel is more the interesting thing, which is that, and this should be bleeding obvious, but anyway, I'm a very slow thinker, which is that the difference is that if you're in VC or PE, you're actually a professional board go tour. That's what your job is,
yep.
Apart from, you know, wasting time outside the board meetings. Whereas, speaking to founders and CEOs, the board is a tiny percentage of their week. Mm-hmm. Most of their entire life is doing something completely different, which is making stuff happen in the real world and their business. So that is actually a huge distinction, which I think hadn't got sufficiently before speaking to you about this, which is that there's a very difference between a professional board goer and someone does it in their spare time. So a lot of the people that I've spoken to who aren't enjoying their board meetings, it's a tiny percentage of their life. And, you know, the night before they say to their wife / husband, and it's mostly men, oh, God, what you're so grumpy about, oh, sorry, I've got a board meeting tomorrow, you know, head in the hands kind of stuff. It's a tiny thing. Whereas if you're in VCs, PEs, it's, you know, day in, day out. Okay, then just carrying on this theme, so just as a little sort of sketch caricature to give a feel for it. So having been on both sides, and let's just forget for the moment sort of VCP difference, it's well made and it's, of course, important. But just let's talk about capital providers, and let's talk about, say, founders / CEOs. So, in the real world, there are good and bad everythings. So, if people are out there after VCs, PEs, capital providers, what's a good one look like, and what's a bad one look like? Just the caricature, so there's a spectrum. And the same, vice versa, if you're VC, PEs, from that side of the fence, what's a good founder CEO like, and what's a bad one like? And there'll be a spectrum between.
A good VCP should, as I said before, be consistent and engaged. That's what you want. Yeah. Ideally, there will also be market and domain experts that can provide you with all those insights and, you know, the networking and recruitment and all those capabilities on top and assist you with fundraising from time to time. But really, you're looking for someone to come in and ideally not just validate your business model and strategy at the outset point of funding, but quickly thereafter, once they have funded your business, to be the champion for your business and to do everything they can within their power to make it a success. And how do you determine what a VC is like? Two things to consider in answering that. One of the best things is obviously to seek references where you can, to go speak to CEOs of some of their businesses, and ideally their failures, not just successes. But equally, let's not kid ourselves, if you're in the UK, you've probably only got five major VCs of note. If you're looking to raise $5 million plus, there's only five you can go to. So the argument is you've got to kind of put up with whatever VC who's the one that's willing to invest in some ways. So most entrepreneurs, particularly in the UK, don't get the luxury of choosing at that scale which VC they end up with. So bizarrely, it doesn't matter what a good VC or bad VC looks like, that's what it is. But I'd say, yeah, consistency is the most important thing. Someone who's going to be a champion for business, someone who understands what's going on and can test and challenge you and seen it before. That's definitely what's, you know, good. And therefore, you know, the bad things are probably just the equal and opposite of that. So someone who's inconsistent, someone who doesn't really know what they're doing, someone who's sort of making it up as they go along. And it's not easy to necessarily determine that, particularly if they're charismatic and sales type people. But just, you know, get a feel nowadays. You can get a feel for their blogs, get a feel for their online presence, get a feel for, as I say, some of the references and referees, and that's as good as you can hope for as a founder entrepreneur trying to choose your VC. But those are the skills you want to see from your VC. On the flip side, as a VC, when you're looking to invest in a company as a VC, not PE, but as a VC, you need to be backing that team and those founders first and foremost. For sure, the market, the product are really, really important. But you'll have already made that decision before you go to that meeting, because you will have a focus on insurtech or fintech or whatever it is, and you'll know whether that company does that or not. So thereafter, it's quickly, who are the team? And then it's just around, what are their motivations? You know, are they experienced? Do they have expertise? And how hard are they going to work to make this a success? And how are they going to work to make this a success? Are they going to be willing to change their mind? That can be seen in some people's as good things, some people's as a weak thing. Or are they going to be dogmatic? You know, what is their approach? What is their flavor? So from a VC looking at an entrepreneur, what makes an entrepreneur good is their willingness, capacity, capability to execute on that plan and build that great business. So that's kind of what you're looking for. It comes, fortunately, in all different shapes and sizes. So, you know, again, I'm jumping around here a little bit, a good VC will be able to spot those different shapes and sizes. They won't just have a bias towards the last three successful CEOs they backed.
Or bias towards extroverts or introverts. You can succeed in life both
ways. Correctly.
Because you say it's different styles. Well, that all makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think the sort of couple of dimensions I'll add. In terms of the VCs, just in terms of what VC means, is that it means two things. It means the firm, but also it means an individual. And again, as you say, there's a relatively limited number in the UK. So one of the amateur errors is to just stick with the firm's reputation.
Correct.
It's the firm cross whoever it is.
And that can change.
You know, exactly.
The VCs can move.
Exactly.
So both the individuals and the firms can change the nature and form. So just because you've got it right on day one doesn't mean you'll be lucky enough for the next 3 or 5 years to have the same thing.
Exactly. And then on the CEO and team size, and actually the board as a whole, which is this point that the West rather lost the vibe from Heraclitus for a couple of thousand years. But everything changes over time. You know, you might be the right CEO for Bond Mason today or your AAA coin today, but you may not be in 5 years' time. And managing that situation well on both sides is super important. And, you know, I have spoken to people where I'm saying to them, well, if you don't enjoy it anymore, well, why don't you move on, mate?
We used to have that conversation in the P-World all the time. I remember drawing this chart. I've probably drawn it 50 times in my life, if not more so. There's five stages, life stages to a business. A CEO can transition generally across one, maybe two, at most three.
And what are the stages?
From startup, scaling up, profitability, and then kind of onto exit and listing. And those are sort of the five stages you go. So it's kind of an S-curve of revenue, if you want to calibrate it in that way. And the person who founds the idea is not going to be the person naturally to take it to IPO and beyond, you know. So getting all the way from A to B is very rare and uncommon. And just because people have done it, by the way, doesn't mean that they do it well. I wouldn't argue that Mark Zuckerberg is the best listed company CEO you will find, yet he's managed to go through all those five different stages. So absolutely, it's a natural thing for CEOs want to transition away from the business as they grow and scale, because your challenges change. It changes from finding product market fit, it changes to building a team, it changes to then putting in a whole load of scalable processes as you go from 50 people to 250 people, and that's what we did in our private equity days. 250 to a couple of thousand, a couple of thousand then to IPO. All those different things require different skills from a CEO. And levels of interest. You know, a CEO who builds and founds a product is rarely going to be interested in
4-hour board meetings with 2-inch thick papers.
Exactly, yes. Which is dealing 80% on regulatory matters. So it's fascinating, but you don't need as a founder to think about having that skill set to take the business to its natural conclusion 20 years down the road. It's, can I take this to a point where another chief executive can take it on with whoever the right capital providers are at that point in time?
Correct, and that's the intellectual perspective, which is a rational perspective, which is completely right. I mean, the challenge is, and you've seen it a million times, of course, which is that human beings aren't just rational, they're emotional, and, you know, it's your little baby, and it's a big thing when you let go of your baby at some stage and hand it over to somebody else. I mean, Steve Jobs, you mentioned Zuckerberg, but Steve Jobs is a prime example. He got pushed out by the man who sold fizzy drinks and came back later, and there was that kind of emotional attachment. You know, we're not just rational creatures. Good, OK, well, as the Oracle of Delphi says, know thyself. Before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I wish you all a fantastic 2019, and I'd like to thank my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest-growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So time has flown by. So Bond Mason, you've got 15 milliseconds to sum up. Chuck your breadcrumbs on the water, say throw them fairly fast, or maybe if you're being really nice, 30 milliseconds. So briefly, Bond Mason, I just mentioned it sort of in half a sentence at the beginning. What are you? What do you do? Who should check you out? Where are you going? What do you need?
Sure. We're an investment manager in the property lending space, is the easy way of looking at us. We, for the last 4 years, have sought out the best loans in the UK secured against property. We've delivered our clients a 6%.
Are we saying investment manager? Your product is a fund then?
We are launching a fund. We have a number of different products. In 15 milliseconds, it probably wouldn't do it justice to go through
I'll give you 25.
Each different one in turn. The key thing is there's a lending portfolio underneath. Our clients get a 6% per annum net return, or that's what they've achieved over each of the last three
and
years.
And the assets are what? I said loans against property.
Loans
what's
secured
that mean
against
in practice?
UK property. So typically
retail.
Or 90% residential, small scale development. In the industry, it's called tart and turn. So something that's bought at auction, done up, maybe a house that's being split into four flats. 6 months to 12 months in terms of length, typically.
And what if I bung some money and what kind of diversification do I get across individual
assets? So at the moment, we've got about 700 live loans. There's no more than 1% of funds in any single opportunity. Diversity is one of our three Ds in terms of managing sort of wealth protection, so diversification, downside protection, and our due diligence. Those are the sort of three things we bring to the table for our clients. What that's meant is for each of the, in touch with the last 162 weeks, we've had consecutive returns. So we've never had a week where the fund performance has sort of gone down. And that really is our emphasis. It's wealth protection first and foremost. So our clients' money should be there clearly at the end of each year and a nice return on top. And that's the emphasis for what we do. which hopefully is quite pertinent given current economic uncertainty as we look ahead in the UK, without mentioning the B word about what's going to happen. That's our emphasis. And why are we different? You know, there's different places and different ways you can access loans secured against property in the UK. Aside from the track record, I think the key thing really is team. So we've got a nice bunch of 18 of us. We like to be personable and approachable. We like to be there for our clients. Yes, we've got a web interface. Yes, I'm on a fintech podcast. But we quite enjoy meeting people. We like them picking up the phone and asking us questions and answering for them.
And what's the size of funds at the moment?
So we've got 20 million of client funds. The range per client is about £5,000 to 3 million, and then the average is about 25,000.
And the sort of regulation or availability, can you buy it if you're in New Zealand, or does it have to be in the UK? Or
98% of our clients are UK-based. There's some international investors, most of those are expats, though, looking for that UK exposure. So although you can buy it internationally, the majority are UK-based.
Okay, and then just wrapping up, is what do you need more of if I was your fairy godmother, or some of the listeners, or prepared to be your fairy godmother in 2019, what do you want more of other than money?
Our challenge as a company is pretty simple. We did a funding round last year, so we're quite well funded. We're really looking just to do more of the same, start spreading the message. We've got, you know, into our fourth year now of 6% per annum net returns. The loan portfolio has got an average loan to value of 56% against UK property, so it's hopefully pretty resilient, pretty conservative. So we're looking really just to spread the word, you know, more retail, high net worth, sophisticated investor type clients. We're not looking for institutional funding. We actually don't want institutional funding. So we just want to stick to the knitting, really.
Excellent. Well, we've covered a huge amount of ground, from stable coins and life inside boards and now loans to UK property. And it's been a nice change from having to sit there and write 12 pages myself on why tech and FS is all going in the wrong direction. So I wish you every success in the future, Stephen. And when you come back, having made your AAA coin stablecoin overtake Bitcoin, you can mention in passing Bond Mason. We'll see how you're getting on, vice versa. So thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on the podcast, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.